listener production.
Hello, Antoinette Latouf here for today's episode of The Weekend Briefing. History is a lot of things. It's fascinating, it's confronting, often shameful, sometimes brutal, and incredibly, incredibly kinky. And it's sex, fetishes, and kinks throughout history that today's guest has committed a huge amount of work to. Esme Louise James is a sex historian, and her work explores the history of human sexuality, including hidden queer histories, plus kinks and fetishes throughout the ages. She's the creator and host of Kinky History, which started as enormously popular TikTok videos, but is now also a podcast and a book of the same name. Esme is also currently a PhD candidate based in Melbourne. Later in today's episode, we have the weekend list. That is where we recommend what to watch, see, do, eat, and listen to. And we've also been taking on some of your tips. So thanks very much for that. But first, here is my chat with Esme Louise James. Esme Louise James, welcome to the weekend briefing.
It's so lovely to be on here. Thank you so much.
I have to start off by asking you your favourite, kinkiest, sexiest discovery in history. Do you have one?
I definitely have one. I think it changes on a weekly basis because I'll find out a new fact and it'll kind of usurp this one. And my current favourite one is that in medieval times, there was a rumour that women would take a fish and insert it inside of themselves. Oh. Wait for it to die and then serve it to their husband as an aphrodisiac. And so women, I really started this on a,
yeah,
on a high, but it was recorded in the Burchard of Worms from the 11th century. And it's the only kind of, and he went into like explicit detail about why women were trying to get their husbands into bed and, you know, trying to produce more children. So they turned to fishy fishes. But we kind of think now that he was actually just writing erotic fan fiction, but for himself.
Were the fish dead or alive when they...
Alive. Then they...
Okay.
Went inside, that's... soaked in their juices and then were served for dinner.
I will never look at a seafood meal the same again.
I know,
that is,
I know.
Some serious prep and serious foreplay.
That is, it's kind of turned me off fish and chips for a long time now, like literal fish fingers. But reading about that was really fascinating. But it also reminds you that even back hundreds of years ago in what we sometimes, you know, classify as the Dark Ages, it's just, it's very much not dark. They were just still filthy.
I love it. I'm traumatized. I can't unhear or unlearn that. I do want to also ask you, like, why sex history? Because it's pretty niche.
It is really niche. It's an interesting journey getting here. I came to university to initially study the history of religion. And the thing about sex, and I think how that came into that, is it's not that far removed from studying something that is a universal human experience of some variety. Sex is essentially the reason we have history at all. So looking at a topic that we... In even in contemporary world, we're still just starting to kind of talk about it in a normal setting. But it's been a part of our history for as long as we've had history, for obvious reasons. And it says a lot about culture and our behaviour and our values, how we practice sex, the same as how we practice eating or sleeping or other forms of relationships. So it's actually a really interesting way to learn more about people from the past, looking at their sexual behaviours, like fish fingers.
Stop it. I'm going to have to ask you to stop talking about fish fingers. Otherwise, I'm going to be forever traumatized. The thing about history is that it can often be boring, but you definitely find super interesting stuff to share, if not slightly traumatizing stuff to share. But how much is it also about the way history is told?
Oh, I think coming from a very academic communication point of view, It is everything. Every historian has a bias. I have a bias. And the way that I will tell history will come from my own interpretations of what I'm reading. The ways and the connections and the things that I make are not the same connections that another historian will make. And that is really important, because telling history and telling the forgotten stories from the past, especially in the work that I do, it's a lot of sexuality, identity, and gender. And when we are able to put back into stories figures and identities that have been forgotten but are so prevalent today, people actually get to see the lineage of the fact that these were always a part of what it means to be human. And something that feels like a novel form of identity expression in the modern world, we actually see it's been there for as long as we've had a recorded history. And so it's so important to tell history in a way that is inclusive. And that's really kind of where I came into this.
In addition to it being about how you tell history, it's also who tells history, which for a long time has been dominated by old, white, boring men, none of which you are. And I want to play this video, which has been watched millions of times, for our listeners to get a bit of a sense and a flavour for the sort of historian that you are.
Kinky facts from history that you didn't know. Medieval women shoved fish inside their hoo-ha to get men into bed. Once the fish was seeped in their juices, they would serve it to their husband as an aphrodisiac. This method was recorded by the 10th century Bertrand of Worms, but may well have been a product of his wishful thinking. Condoms used to be made out of the intestines of animals. This style remained popular until the mid-1800s, with a ribbon tied around the base to secure it. In Sparta, women would cut their hair short once they were married. And some scholars believe this was to make marital relations more comfortable for the man, because they were far more used to having sex with other men.
Did you expect, though, that these historical figures and kinky moments in history to be so big on TikTok?
No. When I first started creating on TikTok, it was a way to communicate in lockdown all of the fun facts that I was learning in my own research to friends and family, because that was just something I really loved doing. I love sharing facts. I'm an oversharer by nature. And I put it on TikTok just as a bit of a whim. And that video, the first video, blew up from my humble perspective at that time. It received 20,000 views and it started developing a following. And I was completely blown away.
What was that video about, that first one?
It was about the oldest dildo recorded in history, which dates back 28,000 years. And it was found in this German cave in 14 fragments. And when they put it together, they essentially found a phallic object that had a ring around the top and was, quote, highly polished at the top from overuse. And they had no other choice but to classify it now as the world's oldest dildo. And we do have dildos from like 5,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, 11,000 years ago. But to this day, 28,000 years is still the oldest known dildo, which is a fascinating fact because, again, we think that of sex toys is really these new things. But we've been using sexual aids and sexual toys longer than we've had writing.
We've always been hornbags.
We really have. That was our priority. It was orgasm first, writing next.
Oh, I love that. So I love that before the alphabet, there was a dildo.
Yes. I think it's so shortly after we invent the wheel. Like, we really have our priorities.
Given that sexual kinks have occurred throughout the ages and documented to varying degrees, why do you think there's still so much shame and secrecy around certain kinks?
It all comes down to when we first defined kinks and fetishes. It was essentially done 200 years ago to define perversion. It was done to treat people rather than to help understand these behaviours and what they mean as part of what it means to be human. And so we go into a time where we, when we develop all of these phrases like homosexuality, like kinks, like fetishes, and masturbation, that it was to say what is not normal. And that is really something we are still trying to unlearn now. When you have language that is seeped in essentially taboo and discrimination, then that carries forward. And so this kind of the phrase kink shaming, I find, is really interesting now, because kink essentially was a word that was used to shame. Like, that's what it meant, essentially. And when you have this definition of kink, it also changes depending on where you live in the world. Kink means a behavior that we just don't classify as normal. And so in some cultures, something like oral sex that we consider normal here would be classified as a kink. And so the thing about kink is that it's a constantly changing, evolving term. And recognizing that flexibility is also so integral to understanding our own behaviors and how sex and our definitions can tell us about people and culture and not just behavior.
And do you think learning about, you know, just how kinky, and I know that word is loaded, famous people were in ancient times, that it can help break down some of that stigma and shame around certain sexual acts?
Absolutely. By current studies that we have, over 50% of our population has behaviours or desires that would classify as kinky. And that is a repeated study that we found in different populations around the world, 50%. And you've got to also remember that people are very non-forthcoming when it comes to admitting about kinky desires and behaviours. So the actual number would be so much higher. Now, when we go back, just like any point in history, and we have this validity of that desire and that kind of freakishness, as we would call it, when we can see ourselves once again in those behaviours in a way that just validates who we are and our ability to work on it. What we do differently in the contemporary world that we haven't been able to do before is that if we do recognise a desire that lives in us that we would classify as kinky, we now have access to educators and the internet to work out how we can actually act on that desire in a way that is ethical and going to benefit more harmonious relationships. That's what makes me really excited about being able to teach something like kinky history now, because I do think we have a potential to kind of change our relationship to sexuality in a way to make it much more ethical.
And so you're currently a PhD candidate at the University of Melbourne, and I'm going to talk about what it is your focus is on. But before that, when did you get interested in sex from an academic viewpoint?
I was always accidentally writing papers on sex. This was pointed out to me in my honours year as I was writing a thesis on this experience of the sublime. So again, this kind of religious concept of something that where you come out of yourself and you feel like you transcend. And I was looking at this experience in literature. And my supervisor very politely one day turned around to me and said, "Esme, you do realize that every time you write about a sublime experience, it generally has to do when two people are having sex in literature or kissing in literature or expressing sexual desires." He's like, "I don't actually think you're here really wanting to talk about religion as much as this idea of sex and it bringing people together." And I remember just sitting there being like, "You are wrong. You are wrong, mister." And then kind of going home that night being like, maybe I need to reconsider literally everything.
And so that's led you down a path of writing a book. You've done a TED Talk, which we'll get to in a minute, and a podcast of the same name. But first, tell us about your PhD and what it is you're focusing on.
So my PhD looks at the emergence of pornography in the 18th century, really when erotic writing comes into fruition. And I look at instances like how erotic literature, what we would call smut novels now, essentially influenced the French Revolution, how it brought about political change, and how pornography started as a social critique and a way to drive revolution. And in doing that, while that's kind of a small niche aspect, it can tell us a lot today about our relationship to pornography, because we on the mass consume this form of media that started as a way to influence public opinion, change social perception, and drive revolution. And I'm kind of urging people, if that's the case, then we need to be a lot more critical about the way that we consume erotic media today.
I can't say I know much about the origins or the state of pornography in the 18th century, but I am struggling to understand how that may relate to pornography today, which is super online, highly commercialized, often predatory. And in what way that's linked to political discourse and civil disobedience.
So something as simple as in the French Revolution, essentially, Marie Antoinette is the perfect example. Pornography was created about Marie Antoinette on the mass, and it's essentially what drove people to hate her, to despise her, which led to her execution. They would describe Marie Antoinette being so sexually degenerate that she was going around pegging other women, that she was making a cuckold of her husband, that she was doing all of these atrocious orgies and making people really mad, being like, but we're paying her taxes and all she's doing is f***ing everyone. How terrible. Now, that's really similar to something that we're seeing with like AI-generated pornography today. The ability to take someone's likeness who's in the public and put them into various scenarios that could tell a falsified story. And it doesn't matter if they can come out and say, that wasn't me, this is AI. It plants a seed. When you're in a state of kind of arousal, you're very susceptible to external influence. And there's been a lot of studies about this from the Kingsey Institute, that if you can see something in an erotic state, say you see a foot or something, it could potentially give you like a bit of a kink for feet. Like, you know, you start to think of feet as a little bit sexy. And they've done a lot of research into that's how potentially fetishes and kinks come about. The same thing is true if you're seeing a celebrity in maybe an erotic state, and it doesn't matter if that's AI generated, it could leave a lasting impression about that person and about what they're doing. And as technology really evolves, I think we need to start being a lot more conscious of that before that takes over, really. And I think there is now a lot more digital literacy, I hope, that will make us be a bit more conscious of what we are consuming. But I still think, you know, you look at the numbers of people who access pornography sites on a daily basis without thinking about what they're consuming, about where it's come from. Nothing good under capitalism is ever free. So when you have people watching free pornographic websites on a daily basis, we are like really essentially creating a system of exploitation that we don't even realize we're a part of. So really what I do in like most aspects of my life, we look back to history to learn what we can be doing better today. And I'm very passionate about that when it comes to pornography, that we are not doing it well.
So I guess what I'm hearing is, in terms of the links of pornography to political activism or public discourse, is the impact AI is having on porn could lead to legislative changes or more public pressure for policymakers to do more.
Absolutely. And I think when you actually have a historical example of how this has happened in the past, it gives a lot more credence to a fear for the future that I think we've already kind of seen come to fruition. So hopefully, you know, that the conversations like this do help bring awareness to this. It's not just a little fear that we have that is completely irrational. There is a lot of basis. This is where porn was born. So let's see where it's going.
A lot of your videos on TikTok are short, you know, 90 seconds and under. You also did a TEDx talk, which is a lot longer. What was it like creating content that's not, you know, pre-produced with multiple takes and is quite long and in front of a live audience? What was that experience like?
Well, at the 7-minute mark, I actually completely forget my speech from TEDx. And it's something that I wasn't ever going to speak about because I was kind of humiliated about it. But I recently put it, I've now seen the funny side of it because no one seemed to notice, which was great. But at one stage during my TEDx talk, I completely blank. I panic. I went to my next slide. All I see is TikTok. And I just kind of muffle and go, I want to talk about TikTok. And then carry on. And my partner now just wants to have an LED I want to talk about TikTok sign in the house, because whenever we don't know what to say, we just say that now. But I think it's definitely a very interesting experience taking something that has been so chronically online in my case, because it did start in 2020 and saw me through the extensive lockdown of Melbourne, to kind of exiting with millions of followers. That's really what happened. And so I found it very, very strange going from like being a little bit of a lonely academic to having a bit of a public persona. And I'd been very hesitant. I used to come from public speaking and a lot of kind of public engagements, but there's something so different about getting up on stage and just being yourself rather than representing a company or giving an academic speech when you're like, this is something I've created and now it's going to be my TEDx talk. And you think like all the time, like it's a bingo card. What's my TED talk going to be if I was going to have one? Like I've said that question a billion times to friends and apparently mine was on kinks and fetishes. So never saw that one coming.
I want to go back to that 7 minute mark. So was it just a bit of a stumble and a pause and then you got back on track, or did you just have to bluff the rest of the way?
I ad-libbed, and when I look back, not very well, but it was good enough to pass. You can see the fear in my eyes. The reason I kind of started, it was fine in the end, but one of the reasons I really wanted to finally talk about it online recently was I think it's a fantastic example of the mistakes that we make. We catastrophize so badly. And most of the time, no one else notices. And in my head, I came off so disappointed that I'd completely screwed up my bucket list TED Talk. Where that wasn't the case. It was a very successful talk. And someone came to me afterwards and they were like, that part where you said I want to talk about TikTok. And I thought they were going to be like, I saw you blunder. But they were like, that was hilarious. I loved how it got really, your talk was really deep. And then you brought it back and it was light again.
Oh, wow.
It was such an interesting thing that sometimes your mistakes can actually become the strength.
Yeah, absolutely. And the pressure we put on ourselves, there is nothing normal about that environment.
No.
You know, and I don't think, and I also think the audience is incredibly forgiving as well, because they probably couldn't get on stage and speak for 18 minutes without any notes.
No.
Live in that kind of pressure cooker scenario.
I think what's interesting is that most people think you have a prompter at TED Talks.
Yes. Yes. That's what I found. Yes. Yeah.
It's not even the lack of prompter, but it's also for the first time you're giving this speech live. Most people have never given that talk before, and then suddenly you have 2,000 people staring at you and a lot of cameras.
Yeah. No, it's really overwhelming. And I think that's where we first crossed paths.
Yes.
I could see the fear in everybody's eyes, either backstage. Everyone was just like, oh, I'm going to stuff this up. But the good thing is, even if you do stuff it up, I was told, because I was like, what if you completely blank? What happens? And they're like, oh, we've had that before. We've had someone go on stage, say nothing, completely blank. Then they took them off stage and they brought them back on later. Other people stop halfway and have a panic attack. The good thing is they edit it out. The online version never looks like that.
No.
And so we're always made to look better than we actually are.
That's why I love the online world.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's my daily basis.
So you also work with your mum, who's a statistician, and you're working on the Sextistics survey. And the aim there is to make the biggest global survey on sexuality. Where are you up to with that?
It is such a fantastic, I think, evolution that I've had being able to work with mum, because I think when you say kinky history, the last thing you think about is maths and stats. And when mum came along, she's really brought this new life into what kinky history can be. And so we've worked on a survey. The first survey we did was in 2021. We put out one video, didn't do very well, but we got from this one video 20,000 responses around the world about a survey we'd created on sexual behavior, identity, gender. It was about a 5-minute survey, and we ended up landing on accidentally one of the biggest surveys that has been done in sexual behavior. 20,000 responses in a research world is a fantastic result. What we were kind of doing differently is, in national surveys that we have on sex and relationships, they're generally about disease and prevention. That is, at the end of the day, what they're trying to get statistics on. It's not about how many people are having queer desires, how many people have had a change in their relationship or their sexuality? How many people have had their views on sex influenced by religion, and when it changed, what changed? And we're not looking at those interesting questions. Things about sex toy sales or engagement in anal really came from a very medical perspective. What we wanted to do differently was change the intention, the motivation, and it changed the result. What we're now working towards, which will hopefully be out and available in the next couple of months, is a larger survey. From one video and in the course of a week, we had 20,000 responses. And so this time we've the help of the some researchers that we've put together and really taken advantage of the social platform, we're hoping to get officially the biggest survey into sexual behaviour that has been done. We had 100 countries last time. We really want to look at studies that haven't been done about like cross-cultural differences in sexual behaviours and beliefs, the impact of disability on sexuality, the impact of age, all of these interesting topics that people, when we first put out Sexistics, wanted us to talk about, and we had to keep on saying there's not a lot of research. So it kind of came to us like, we could be the ones who do that. We have the skills and we have now the platform, and that's such an honour.
How do you account for the fact that in some cultures or some corners of the world, being forthcoming about sex is far less likely, and so that the sample you may get may be those who are more open to experience, kinks, fetishes, or at the very least talking about
I think first and foremost, acknowledging that bias. I'm very fortunate now to have connected with some fantastic creators, academics in so many different corners of the world. And I've spoken to some of them about this exact issue. For instance, one of the places that we are doing a lot of work with now is going to be India. And there is a big difference in a lot of, just like there is here, between like very conservative, very progressive views of sexuality. But what we are really wanting to ensure that we do is we don't just want the kind of what we would classify as progressive people to come forward. We're also really interested in all different perceptions and views of sexuality and their influence. So when we have been very conscious in when we're looking at how you put out this survey, going to other universities to help us distribute, going to other creators and people who would be able to help us who are potentially not from the same views or beliefs that we're coming from, which has actually been a really nice exercise so far. So to really undercut the bias we definitely had last time.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I can't imagine someone wanting to do a sex survey who's like, I have had one sexual partner. I enjoy missionary once a month.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know? You don't want to sit down for a half an hour survey when you're like, I don't want to answer any of these questions. So
yeah, no, no, no. Do you have this desire? No, no, no. Have you? No.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess, all you can do in research is, you know, acknowledge bias and limitations and do your best to collaborate with other academics. My final question is, what is it like to work so closely with your mum about sex? Have you guys had to have any boundaries, or have there been any TMI moments?
I mean, there's definitely a lot of TMI moments. There's too many. Like, for instance, one of my favourite things about working with my mum is that she really doesn't have a filter. And so when I get text messages from her, they are absolutely hilarious. I literally had one 2 days ago being like, darling, did you see the new stats? Everyone in Queensland loves anal. And I'm like, please. And there was so many over the course of, she like helped write on the book, write the stats in my book with me. And the updates that I would get, sometimes she'd be like, hi honey, what are you doing today? I'm just finishing up masturbation. Did you want to do cock rings? And like, just these would pop up on my phone, and I made a little folder of them. And at one of our book launches, I did just really call her out on all of the funniest messages I'd gotten from her. But to answer the question, it is such a delight. It's such a privilege, and it really puts into practice what we're preaching. Openness about sex and being able to talk about it, and doing that at not only the level of doing this research and this communication, but doing it with me and mum as the spokespeople and also talking to one another, it's incredible. You know, my nan is now desperate to get involved as well. And I think there's something so rich adding to the conversation when you have all of these different generations and different perspectives able to share their experiences. Yeah. And it is really, really wonderful. And people on the internet have really connected with it.
Yeah, I would love that, to be at a family dinner and we'll be like, Mom, tell Nana what we found out about Queenslanders.
I think the funniest thing is that sometimes we'll be chatting and Nan's like, well, girls, you forgot about this. Have you talked about this? And she'll say like the most outlandish stuff. I'm like, Nana, like, come on.
Oh, that's great. I love it. Oh, it has been such a joy and a pleasure chatting with you.
Oh, this has been absolutely wonderful. It's really fantastic to see people who've connected over something so incredible like a TED Talk experience to be able to follow each other's journeys.
That is Esme Louise James, the creator of Kinky History, which is on TikTok, but also now a podcast and a book of the same name. It's your favourite time of the weekend. That's because Helen Smith is here with the weekend list. That is where we help you navigate what to watch, what to eat, what to see, what to do. We're pretty much here to be your unofficial life coaches. We just don't have the qualifications. Helen, what is your first recommendation?
So my first recommendation is food. It's a new kind of work lunch that I've been obsessed with lately. Mm-hmm. And they're these glass noodle jars that you prep at home.
Okay.
So they're a hot lunch, which I love.
In glass?
Yeah, but that's the thing. I was just going to say, I don't use glass because I don't trust that. Like, yeah. I'm not putting hot water in a glass thing. Like, how sturdy? Oh, how sturdy
the
are
noodles
these?
Are glass noodles.
No.
The jars are glass?
Both. Yeah, anyway.
Okay.
So it's gone. Okay. But what I do is I use those red containers, the little circle red containers, and you can steam the top. Anyway, it's just a container, hot, waterproof, microwave proof.
Mm-hmm.
And you put at the bottom some shredded vegetables, then some protein. I do tofu because mm-hmm. I don't want it to get all gross.
Mm-hmm.
And then glass noodles. And then I have a miso paste as well that I put in it. And you can also put like soy sauce, sesame oil, and crushed up peanuts. Like you can put that on the top.
The crunch, yep.
Yeah. And you put them all together. So the wet things go at the bottom and then you go.
And so you kind
up.
Of bulk prep them, meal prep.
Yep. You can bulk meal prep them.
Yeah.
And then all you have to do is bring it into work, add hot water at work, add the miso paste because mine's in a little sachet, or you can pre-add it in there already.
Yeah.
Add the hot water and there you go. And it's healthy, yummy. Like fills you up and you're just like, yes, this is a good, and there's veggies. Like, yeah,
that's my. And it seems budget conscious as well.
It is budget conscious, but I'm not sure about the jars. Don't put it in a glass jar.
Okay. My first recommendation, well, off the back of that fabulous chat with Esme Louise James, is to check out her TED Talk. For two reasons, her TEDx talk.
Mm.
One, because it's interesting. Her TEDx is writing kinky sex back into the history pages. You get to see her on stage. But also, after you look that up on YouTube, underneath it is Esme's confession, which she only did a couple of months ago. It took her that long to come out with it, that she forgot her lines on stage and completely froze 3 minutes in. And so what you see edited is the edited version, because that's I actually met Esme, because we both did our TEDx's the same year. You don't see the bloopers. Anyway, so she comes clean about what it's like. And I think it's important to see that, because she's someone who performs so well, has this really successful podcast, has this big social following, that even somebody like her with a book and a podcast and a PhD and blah, 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 can still have these sort of pretty bucket list moments and completely freeze. So I love that vulnerability and that admission. It actually makes me love Esme even more. So that is my first recommendation. Check it out on YouTube, Writing Kinky Sex Back into the History Pages. And then underneath that, you should see Esme's admission reel.
Hmm. I do like that as well. Makes it more human.
It does.
Like, you know what? You are like an overachiever in everything in
Absolutely.
Life.
Absolutely.
But that makes me feel a bit better.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do like that. So my next recommendation is a little relaxation thing, I guess. It's the adult colouring books. I bought one from Kmart and it's a de-stress colouring book. So it actually has activities in it as well as colouring books, like, you know, the normal kind of word searches and all that kind of thing. But it also has pages where you have to draw an emotion, like think of an emotion, happy, angry, sad, and draw whatever comes out, like whatever comes out of your hand. And it's just like how you represent yourself with just like your drawing. Like I did excited and it was just like scribbles on the page. Yeah. But it's a really good way. I think at the moment there's so much going on in the world and your phone can be so overwhelming. Mm. It's actually so nice to just get some colored pencils and do some colouring or do some drawing.
Yeah, it's really nice mindfulness. Like I do it begrudgingly with my daughters a lot. Yeah. But then like initially begrudgingly I colour in. And then when I'm actually doing it, I'm like, I'm really enjoying this.
Yeah, it's
I'm thinking
really nice.
Nothing else other than keeping like the yellow staying in between the lines.
Another good one that just popped into my head that's a great stress relief is bouldering. Have you ever tried that?
Like rock climbing type thing
but
indoors.
Indoors.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, oh, outside.
I haven't done it for years.
It is so, like, I'm like, oh, because you can't think of anything else because there's no rope. Like,
that's
you're just
true.
Bouldering.
You're just thinking about
you're
the next
literally
thing.
Only thinking about.
Oh, I love
that. I have to, like, if I do this, I'm going to drop, like, onto the mats.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, it really keeps you present. Like, you cannot think of anything else. And if you do, you will fall.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bouldering and colouring in if you're not that, you know, adventurous or physically active. My final recommendation is for a couple of reasons. I'm trying to buy less clothes for financial reasons, but also to not be such a douche and horrible to the environment because I have bought into fast fashion and I've had to block all the Shein and Temu and things on my phone that pops up and Zara.
From the emails.
Yeah, so I just don't see anything. So I have friends and we have been doing a clothes swap. We go to each other's and we raid one another's wardrobe and it feels like you're having something new and you realize that you only wear about 40% of what's in your wardrobe anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's a way to, and so it's a way to get some wardrobe space, but also to feel that you're getting new outfits and not being awful to the environment. And so there's only one caveat there. You have to have friends who have the same shoe size as you. Cause I have a close girlfriend's WhatsApp group and I'm like, who is a 7.5? And then a few of them responded. And I was like, okay, the rest of you are dead to me. Yeah. I don't need any friends whose feet.
Sorry, you cannot come over. You're not invited.
And so obviously it only works. But there are other things that you can share even if you don't have the same clothing or foot size. Bags and scarves and hats and, you know, bits and pieces. So I recommend that if your friends are up for it.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. And it also gets everyone together. It's so hard to get adults and friends together.
Yeah.
So I love that.
Yeah, it's a good one. Give it a crack. But I'm not recommending that you unfriend people who don't share your shoe size.
No. Not saying that.
It's a bit glass slipperish, Cinderella. God, we've gone from glass noodles to glass slippers, coming full circle. But thanks for those recommendations, Helen, and we'll catch you next week. That is it from me for this week. But of course, there is another Weekend Briefing tomorrow with Tom Tilley. Tom Tilley, what have you got?
So I'm about to interview one of the contestants of Alone. So that's the series where they drop 10 people into the bush and see who lasts the longest. We're talking to Andreas Lunden. He's a 43-year-old Swedish guy who is an amateur hunter, a survivalist. He kills his own meat with a bow and arrow for fun on the weekends. So that makes him pretty well placed for this series. And he's about to take us into the minutiae, the decisions they have to make on a daily basis, on how they use their energy, how they spend their calories to survive. So I hope you enjoy it. Listener.